washed by all the rules, brainwashed by our leaders, by our kings and queens, brainwashed in the open and brainwashed behind the scenes.
Is highly confused.
He is a normaton.
Let's challenge his shattered view of the world.
Here's a little wedge for the never believer. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Why don't you go with you? Lay on the things we know. Why don't you stand up for truth? Why don't you turn away to? You saw all of the things that's wrong. Would you stand tall and strong? Or would you turn and walk away? What would you do if you knew all the things we knew?
Love is the only truth, everything else is illusion.
Welcome to Total Information Radio, live on the Revere Radio Network, the worldwide home of free speech, accessible via revereradio.org, revereradio.info, total411.info, and revereradionetwork.com. So check all that out. And we have various things lined up for you tonight.
Mr. Gura.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. All 50 states allow law-abiding citizens to defend themselves and their families in their homes with ordinary functional firearms, including handguns. I'd like to respond to the point about the District of Columbia's position over the years with respect to the functional firearms ban. The petitioners have had two opportunities to urge courts to adopt this so-called self-defense exception that they construe in the amendment. The first opportunity came in 1978 in McIntosh versus Washington, where the petitioners urged the Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia to uphold the law because it was rational in their view to prohibit self-defense in the home with firearms. They deemed it to be too dangerous and that this was a legitimate policy choice of the city council, and they actually prevailed in that view. The second opportunity that the petitioners had to urge this sort of self-defense construction was actually in this case, in the district court. We had a motion for summary judgment, and we made certain factual allegations in this motion. And on page 70A of the joint appendix, we see portions of our statement of undisputed material facts. Fact number 29, which was conceded by the District of Columbia, reads, "The defendants prohibit the possession of lawfully owned firearms for self-defense within the home, even in instances when self-defense would be lawful by other means under District of Columbia law." The citation for that is a functional firearms ban, and that point was conceded. Certainly, the idea that people could guess as to when it is that they might render their firearm operational is not one that the court should accept, because a person who hears a noise, a person who perhaps is living in a neighborhood where there's been a spate of violent crimes, has no idea when it is that the District of Columbia would permit her to render the firearm operational, and in fact there is a prosecution history, not under this specific provision, but certainly under other gun prohibition laws that we are challenging here today, to prosecute people for the possession or for the carrying of a prohibited firearm, even when the police rule the shooting has been lawful self-defense, where there is no prosecution for assault or attempted murder or anything of that.
You're saying that this is unreasonable, and that really is my question. Because I'd like you to assume two things with me, which you probably don't agree with, and I may not agree with them either. But I just want you to assume them for the purpose of the question. Assume that there's an individual right, but the purpose of that right is to maintain a citizen army, call it a militia. That's the basic purpose. So it informs what's reasonable and what isn't reasonable. Assume, and this is favorable to you, but not as favorable as you'd like, assume that we're going to decide whether something is proportionate or apply an intermediate standard in light of the purpose. All right? Now focus on the handgun ban. As I read these 80 briefs, and they were very good, I mean really good and informative on both sides, and I'm trying to boil down the statistics where there's disagreement. Roughly what I get, and don't quarrel with this too much, it's very rough, that 80 to 100,000 people every year in the United States are either killed or wounded in gun-related homicides or crimes or accidents or suicides, but suicides are more questionable. That's why I say 80 to 100,000. In the district, I guess the number is somewhere around 200 to 300 dead, and maybe if it's similar, 1,500 to 2,000 people wounded. All right. Now, in light of that, why isn't a ban on handguns, while allowing the use of rifles and muskets, a reasonable or a proportionate response on behalf of the District of Columbia?
Because, Your Honor, for the same reason it was offered by numerous military officers at the highest levels of the U.S. military at all branches of service, writing in two briefs, they agree with us that the handgun ban serves to weaken America's military preparedness, because when people have handguns are military arms, they're not just civilian arms, they are better prepared and able to use them, and certainly when they join the military forces, they are issued handguns. And so if we assume the sort of military purpose to the Second Amendment as an individual right, then the handgun ban, as noted by our military amici, would impede
I read the two military briefs as focusing on the nature of the right, which was quite a pretty good argument there, but the nature of the right is to maintain a citizen army. And to maintain that potential today, the closest we come is to say that there is a right for people to understand weapons, to know how to use them, to practice with them. And they can do that, you see, with their rifles. They can go to gun ranges, I guess, in neighboring states. But does that make it unreasonable for a city with a very high crime rate, assuming that the objective is what the military people say, to keep us ready for the draft if necessary, is it unreasonable for a city with that high crime rate to say no handguns here?
You want to say
why?
Yes. That's your answer.
Yeah, well, you want to say yes, that's correct, but I want to hear what the reasoning is, because there's a big crime problem. I'm simply getting you to focus on that.
The answer is yes, as Justice Scalia noted, and it's unreasonable, and it actually fails any standard of review that might be offered under such a construction of the individual right, because proficiency with handguns, as recognized as a matter of judicial notice by the First Circuit in Casas back in 1942, that was a handgun case where the First Circuit examined the restriction on the carrying of a .38 caliber revolver, and the First Circuit accepted, as a matter of judicial notice, that proficiency in use and familiarity with the handgun at issue would be one that would further a militia purpose.
And so, this question, in answering yes, do you attach any significance to the reference to the militia in the Second Amendment?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
You think that is, to understand the amendment, you must pay some attention to the militia requirement?
Yes, Your Honor, we must.
So a conscientious objector who likes to hunt deer for food, you would say, has no rights under the Second Amendment. He's not going to be part of the militia. He's not going to be part of the common defense, but he still wants to bear arms. You would say that he doesn't have any rights under this amendment?
No, Your Honor. I think that the militia clause informs the purpose, informs a purpose. It gives us some guideposts as to how we look at the Second Amendment, but it's not the exclusive purpose of the Second Amendment. Certainly the founders cared very much.
Is it any limitation on the legislature? Is it first clause, any limitation on the legislature?
It is a limitation to one extent, Your Honor. The extent recognized in Miller, where the Miller court asked whether or not a particular type of arm at issue is one that people may individually possess. They looked at the militia clause and therefore adopted a militia purpose as one of the two prongs of Miller. And so certainly if the court were to continue Miller and Miller was the only guidance that the lower court had, certainly, as to what arms are protected or unprotected by the Second Amendment, then yes.
If it limits the kind of arms to be appropriate to militia, why does it not also limit the kind of people who may have arms?
It does not limit the kind of people, Your Honor, because the Second Amendment is the right of the people, and it would certainly be an odd right that we would have against the Congress if Congress could then redefine people out of that right. Congress could tomorrow declare that nobody's in the militia, and then nobody would have a right against the government.
If you were thinking of the people, what those words meant when the Second Amendment was adopted, it was males between the ages of what, 17 and 45? People who were over 45 had no, they didn't serve in the militia.
Well, certainly there were many people who were not eligible for militia duty or not subject to militia service who nevertheless were expected to, and oftentimes did, in fact, have guns.
Which shows that maybe you're being unrealistic in thinking that the second clause is not broader than the first. It's not at all uncommon for a legislative provision or a constitutional provision to go further than is necessary for the principal purpose involved. The principal purpose here is the militia, but the second clause goes beyond the militia and says the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Now, you may say the kind of arms is colored by the militia, but it speaks of the right of the people. So why not acknowledge that it's broader than the first clause?
Oh, we do acknowledge that, Your Honor.
Then why have the first clause? I mean, what's it doing? I mean, what help is it going to be?
Well, it was a way in which to remind us. The framers certainly felt that a militia was very important to the preservation of liberty. The framers had just fought a revolutionary war that relied heavily on militia forces. And so they wanted to honor that and remind us as to the purpose, one purpose, not the exclusive purpose, but a purpose of preserving the rights of people.
There also be something to reaffirm that the provisions in the main text of the Constitution remained intact.
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact, that view was taken by William Raleigh in his 1828 treatise, View of the Constitution. Raleigh, of course, was a ratifier of the Second Amendment. He sat in the Pennsylvania Assembly in 1790, and if we look at his description of the Second Amendment, he bifurcates it. First, he discusses the militia clause, and he lavishes some qualified praise on it. And then
you were about to tell us before, of course, that the question began about the other purposes that the amendment served. I want to know whether or not, in your view, the operative clause of the amendment protects, was designed to protect in an earlier time, the settler in the wilderness and his right to have a gun against some conceivable federal enactment which would prohibit him from having any guns.
Oh, yes. Yes, Justice Kennedy. The right of the people to keep and bear arms was derived from Blackstone. It was derived from the common law English right, which the founders wanted to expand. In fact, the chapter in which Blackstone discusses in his treatise his fifth auxiliary right to arms is entitled...
That brings me back to the question, because Blackstone describes it as a right to keep and bear arms under law. And since he uses the words under law, he clearly foresees reasonable regulation of that right. And so does the case not hinge on, even given all your views, on whether it is or is not a reasonable or slightly tougher standard thing to do to ban the handgun while leaving you free to use other weapons. I mean, I noticed that the malicious statute, the first one, spoke of people coming to report in 1790 or whenever with their rifles, with their muskets, but only the officers were to bring pistols. So that to me suggests they didn't see pistols as that crucial, even then, let alone now.
Well, certainly they saw...
What's your response is the question.
Well, my response is that the government can ban arms that are not appropriate for civilian use. There's no question of that.
And that are not appropriate to?
That are not appropriate to civilian use.
For example,
I think machine guns. It's difficult to imagine a construction of Miller or a construction of the lower court's opinion that would sanction machine guns or the plastic undetectable handguns that the Solicitor General spoke of. The fact is that this court's Miller test is the only guidance that we had below, and I think it was applied faithfully. Once a weapon is, first of all, an arm under the dictionary definition, and Webster has a very useful one, then you look to see whether it's an arm that is meant to be protected under the Second Amendment, and we apply the two-pronged Miller test. And usually, one would imagine if an arm fails the Miller test because it's not appropriate for common civilian applications.
But why wouldn't the machine gun qualify? General Clement told us that that's standard issue in the military.
But it's not an arm of the type that people might be expected to possess commonly in ordinary use. That's the other aspect of Miller. Miller spoke about the militia as encompassing the notion that people would bring with them arms of the kind in common use applied by themselves. And
is there any parallel?
At this time, I'd just like to follow up on what you said, because if you were right that it was at that time, yes, but that's not what Miller said. It says that the gun in question there was not one that at this time, the time of the Miller decision, has a reasonable relationship to the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia. So it's talking about this time.
That's correct. The time frame that the court must address is always the present. The framers wish to preserve the right to keep and bear arms. They wish to preserve the ability of people to act as militia. And so there was certainly no plan for, a technical obsolescence. However, the fact is that Miller spoke very strongly about the fact that people were expected to bring arms supplied by themselves of the kind in common use at the time. And so if in this time people do not have or not recognized by any court to have a common application for, say, a machine gun or a rocket launcher or some other sort
of... Is there any parallel at the time that the amendment was adopted to the machine gun? In other words, I understand your point to be that although that's useful in modern military service, it's not something civilians possessed. Was there anything like that at the time of the adoption, or were the civilian arms exactly the same as the ones you'd use in the military?
At the time, even at the time Miller was decided, the civilian arms were pretty much the sort that we're using in the military. However, it's hard to imagine how a machine gun could be a lineal descendant, to use the D.C. Circuit's wording, of anything that existed back in 1791, if we want to look to the framing era.
It seems to me that Miller, as we're discussing it now, and the whole idea that the militia clause has a major effect in interpreting the operative clause as both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. I mean, I would have to agree with Justice Ginsburg that a machine gun is probably more related to the militia now than a pistol is. But that seems to me to be allowing the militia clause to make no sense out of the operative clause in present-day circumstances.
Well, Your Honor, even within the militia understanding, the understanding of the militia was always that people would bring whatever they had with them in civilian life. So if a machine gun, even though it may be a wonderful...
My point is, why is that of any real relevance to the situation that faces the homeowner today?
It's only of relevance if the court wishes to continue reading the militia clause as informing the type of weapon which is protected.
Well, you're being faithful to Miller. I suggest that Miller may be deficient.
I agree with Your Honor, and certainly in our brief we suggest that the militia emphasis of Miller is not useful as a limiting principle for the type of arms that may be permitted, because on the one hand, there's a great deal of weaponry that might be wonderful for military duty but is not appropriate for common civilian use, which would not be protected even under the military first prong. And on the other hand, everything that civilians today might wish to have in ordinary common use, handguns, rifles, and shotguns, are militarily useful weapons. So we de-emphasize the military aspects of Miller as being ultimately not very useful guidance for courts. And the better guidance would be to emphasize the common sense rule that I think judges would have really no trouble applying, and we do this all the time in constitutional law, to simply make a decision as to whether or not whichever arm comes up at issue is an arm of the kind that you could really reasonably expect civilians to.
How do you explain the fact, if you include self-defense, that only two states, Pennsylvania and Vermont, did refer to self-defense as a permissible justification, and all the others referred to common defense or defense of the state? So, and in the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution itself, there's no reference to self-defense.
Your Honor, the state courts interpreting those provisions that you referenced had a different interpretation. For example, in 1895, Massachusetts...
1895. I'm talking about contemporaneous with the adoption of the Second Amendment.
Well, at the time, we haven't seen state court decisions from exactly that era.
Just the text of the state constitutional provisions. Two of them refer to self-defense. The rest refer only to common defense. Is that not correct?
On their literal text, yes, but judges do not interpret them that way. For example, in North Carolina.
I understand that the judicial interpretation sometimes is controlling and sometimes is not, but the text itself does draw a distinction, just as the Second Amendment does. It doesn't mention self-defense.
While it might not mention self-defense, it was clear that the demands that the states made at the ratifying conventions were for an individual right, and Madison was interested
in... But if you look at the individual rights, I suppose you start back in 1689 in the Declaration of Rights in England, and the seventh provision that they talked about said that the subjects which are Protestants may have arms for their defense suitable to their conditions and as allowed by law. Now, do you think the term suitable to their conditions limited the number of people who had access to arms for self-defense?
It was in England, but that was criticized by the framers. St. George Tucker's edition of Blackstone.
Do you think that the Second Amendment is a departure from the provision in the Declaration of Rights in England?
It's quite clearly an expansion upon it.
You would not confine the right the way the English did then.
I think the common law of England is a guide, and it's always a useful guide because that's where we look to interpret.
Useful for such purposes is what keep and bear arms means and things of that sort.
It certainly is, Your Honor, and it's also useful to see how...
They certainly didn't want to preserve the kind of militia that America had, which was a militia separate from the state, separate from the government, which enabled the revolt against the British.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You, of course, were just... listening to the arguments before the Supreme Court in the D.C. Gun rights case. As far as I can tell, the main problem with it is that the Second Amendment, of course, guarantees and reaffirms the right already held by all free men, basically, in all the states. And D.C., of course, is not a state. So it's kind of strange, but... we'll see what happens there. And it's pretty interesting, though, if you were watching some of the C-SPAN coverage of it. They have that show where everyone can call in, and you can tell that there are people calling in from poor areas in D.C., down the southeast, Marion Barry, and just bitching about, you know, they can't protect themselves. They don't have any guns. And, just real people. So, there you go. One thing we do often on the program is call Ron Paul for the weekly legislative update. Let's see what he's up to.
Hello, this is Ron Paul with your weekly update for March 16th. House Democrats recently adopted a budget with massive tax hikes, many of which are directed at those Americans who can at least afford them. By allowing the Bush tax cuts to expire in 2010, this budget will raise income taxes not only on those in the highest income brackets, but raises the lowest brackets from 10% to 15% as well. Estates would again be taxed at 55%. The child tax credit would drop from $1,000 to $500. Senior citizens relying on investment income would be hurt by increases in dividend and capital gains taxes. It's not just that the Democrats want to raise taxes on the rich. They want to raise taxes on everybody. The problem is policing the world is expensive. And if elected officials insist upon continuing to fund our current foreign policy, the money has to come from somewhere. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have already cost us over $1 trillion. The Democrats' budget gets the president all the funding he needs for his foreign policies, so one wonders how serious they ever were about ending the war. While Democrats propose to tax and spend, many Republicans aim to borrow and spend, which hurts the taxpayer perhaps as much. Supporting a welfare state is expensive as well. Over half of our budget goes to mandatory entitlements. The total cost of government now eats up over half of our national income, as calculated by Americans for Tax Reform, and government is growing at an unprecedented rate. Our current financial situation is completely untenable, and the worst part is, as government is becoming more and more voracious, the economy is shrinking. The bottom line is that Washington has a serious spending addiction. While both parties debate how to raise the revenues, both parties seem happy to spend over $3 trillion of your money in various ways. While some in Washington criticize the war in Iraq, very few are criticizing the interventionist mindset that got us into the war in the first place. Many so-called Iraq war critics criticize this administration rather than truly opposing the decades-old policies that led to war. They claim that they will eventually get the troops out of Iraq, but the danger is that they simply plan to move them around to other countries, not bring them home. The American people want peace. Minding our own business is the best way to achieve it. Not only is it also a lot cheaper, but free trade and friendship will, with other countries, benefits all involved. This spending spree is exactly the wrong policy for an economy on the brink of recession. History has shown that all empires eventually crumble under a worthless currency and an exhausted military.
All right. Thanks, Ron Paul. Kind of boring, but thanks anyway. Where else can we go tonight? We do have a phone number at 1-877-REVERE-0. That's 1-877-738-3730. You know, one thing we like to do on this program is listen to DJ Jeff Shore, or a friend up in Canada, calling people about 9/11. And we have some new audio. So let's check that out. Here we go. This is calling a fellow named Mike Pazian.
Good morning, Mike Pazian.
Hi, Mike.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Jeffrey Hill.
Yes.
The reason I was calling you was because I was talking to a few ex-Boeing engineers. And we were talking about flight speeds of different airplanes. And I was told by somebody that you would be the guy to talk to about the maximum speed of a Boeing 767 at 700 feet altitude.
Okay.
What would be the approximate max speed at 700 feet altitude for a Boeing 767?
What do you mean by max speed? The maximum the airplane can fly at, or the maximum that the airplane is allowed to fly at?
The maximum it could fly at.
I don't know.
Would you be able to
test at that?
Would you have like a ballpark figure on it, or?
Hold on. The maximum, do you say 700 feet? 700 feet?
700 feet altitude, yeah. Okay, so
it's not quite Mach 1, but...
And again, this is Mike Pazian, who works for the FAA in Seattle. He works in the aircraft certification office.
So you would say, would it be able to fly 500 miles an hour at 700 feet?
Yeah.
Not a problem?
Well, the airplane won't break apart.
But there shouldn't be any problem flying at that altitude, at that speed?
What do you intend to do with the aircraft at that speed? I mean, I don't know if it'll be able to do a level flight at that speed. It's usually a dive speed at 700 feet.
Would it be hard to control the aircraft at 500 miles an hour at 700 feet?
Level flight?
Coming in from a dive or anything.
I don't know if that's ever been demonstrated. We just demonstrate that the plane won't break up at dive speed at 700 feet. Now, whether it's controllable or not, I don't know.
Would you be able to make a sharp banked left turn while you're flying at that speed?
I'm not a pilot. I haven't flown that aircraft.
So as far as you know, it is possible that it could go that speed, at that altitude?
Probably not.
Probably not?
Probably not. If you try to bank, you'll probably break the airplane. Because your loads start to change dramatically.
Okay. Do you know what I'm getting at here?
No, I don't.
Yeah?
No, I don't.
Well, the reason I was asking was because the official report for the 9/11, the 9/11 flights.
Okay.
We had the second airplane calculated at about 500 miles an hour at 700 feet altitude.
Okay.
When it was going into the building.
All right.
And so, from what I gathered from what you're saying, it couldn't have made those maneuvers. Or even flown at that speed at that altitude.
Apparently it did.
Well, apparently it did, but, in reality,
Well, that is reality. It did. It made it. What I'm talking about is purely theory.
Okay, but
apparently 9/11 proved that the theory is wrong, because the airplane was able to do what it did.
And make a real...
If you're right that they were flying at 500 miles an hour.
And make a sharp left bank just before it entered the building at 500 miles an hour at 700 feet altitude. But we...
Or closer to 600 by many, many conventional calculations.
Just discussed that you couldn't do that.
Well, maybe your calculation of that it was going 500 miles an hour is wrong.
Oh. Okay, and what position do you hold at the FAA?
Could you tell me who you're with? Are you a reporter, or...?
I'm just an average citizen trying to find out some answers.
Okay. I'm in the propulsion branch here in the aircraft certification office.
Okay, well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Okay.
And trying to help me with the question I had.
All right.
If I have any more questions, I'll get back to you.
Yeah, could you tell me who referred you to me?
It was an ex-engineer. His name's Joseph Keith. I think you had some email correspondence with him.
Yeah.
And he was just trying to find out the maximum speed. And you guys had worked out some formulas.
Mm-hmm.
And what you had sent him was wrong. If you want me to go over the formulas, I could.
Oh, that's okay.
No?
All right.
Okay, you have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Too fucking funny. Okay. There was our friend, DJ Jeff L. Shore from way up in Canada, where, you know, he's just taping international phone calls. It's the Canadian Terrorist Surveillance Program is what it is. Where else can we go tonight? Oh, we got a phone call. You're live on Revere Radio Network.
Yeah, I'm actually still listening to that interview.
Oh, it just ended. Good timing.
Let me turn down the sound then, because I guess there's a delay on that. Yes, what a great job Jeff has done here. All you'd have to call this guy to testify. You wouldn't even have to take the trouble to have him testify. All you'd have to do is get an affidavit from him that that is indeed him on the phone talking, and that none of it has been edited, that it's accurate. That's testimony right there.
Yeah, well, apparently Joseph Keith, who's done good work, also has a bunch of emails from him. If you might have missed that at the very end of the call, he asked Jeff where he got his number, and he said he got it from Joseph Keith, who's a former Boeing engineer who said basically the same thing. And so there, it's all on the record.
Well, if this ever got into a court, it'd be laughed. I mean, it'd be torn apart. Well, here's what would happen. Instead, probably the official story would be changed to say, well, we don't know how fast it was flying. Maybe it was flying at 400 miles per hour. Maybe it was flying at 300 miles per hour. But that makes the videos look even more ridiculous. Because in order for the thing to get any penetration of anything at all, it would have had to be moving pretty damn fast.
Yeah, well, I think the video calculations are like 600 miles an hour. I've done some myself. Of course, the problem is the videos aren't all internally consistent.
Yeah, they're all discordant, including the so-called real time, which I imagine was several seconds delayed. You know, September Clues goes into all this, and 9/11 Octopus and so forth,
well,
including.
What I've got on my YouTube account, which is Total 411 Info. I've got not the live shot, but the instant replay of WABC footage. It was on Fox News about 2 minutes later. Interesting, because it might not be exactly the same thing that was shown at first, but it looks to me like it's almost like too clean, like they have to dirty it up some later.
When Nico Halp did his formal presentation to New York 9/11 Truth, when there still was a New York 9/11 Truth, I don't know what it is now, but
I'm not sure. I heard a rumor they're back in the church.
I'm going to make a note to follow up on that, because we need to know what those developments are. But anyway, Halp among other things, he presented conflicting videos. Now, let me explain something to you. When you show a jury three or four different videos of what is supposed to be the same event, and make it clear to them that these things are impossible. One of them, that all but one at the very least must be wrong, right? Because you couldn't have inconsistent, you know, it's the whole parallax view thing. You couldn't possibly have inconsistent views of the same, and it's easy enough to do that. To me, you don't even need to call experts to testify. There's nothing expert about this. Really, it ain't rocket science. It ain't rocket science. So this is stunning to me, because what Jeff has done here is this is exactly the questions that you would take in a deposition or ask him if he was up on the stand. And all you got to do is get it notarized to say, oh, yeah, that's me in that interview. And you play that interview for a jury, and there it is. He's essentially saying that the official report is physically impossible or mistaken. Those are the only two conclusions that can reasonably be drawn from what he says, that the official version that the thing was flying.
And then he backtracks and says, well, it's just a theory, like it's, you know, not like, I don't want to say elementary physics, but, you know, near elementary physics is just some abstract theory, and, you know, 9/11 proved it wrong. And so I don't know, there's a good chance that I think that at least some of Jeff's interviews are going to be entered into a court record. I think I think there's a good chance Morgan Reynolds will do that. I know he cites Jeff's audio in his articles and that sort of thing. So
right. So what we have to do, what people really need to do, is to establish a public historical record And I'm not talking about a lot of, like, you know, random stuff like what we had with the, we didn't have too many, the closest thing we had to a formal record of evidence in the Kennedy assassination, for example, was all the stuff that Jim Garrison managed to get a hold of in his investigation. And then, of course, we had the House committee hearings in 1979 that got even more of the stuff, but they still got stuff buried. But in this case, we don't even need to do that.
Is there anyone home? Come on down. I hear you breathing.
estimate is that they'll try to make McCain president. I say that he's the von Hindenburg who paves the way for whatever kind of Hitler they got in mind. The whole thing is this: if they try to install McCain, if they try to install a Clinton, you're already going to have almost immediately, right, prima facie, ipso facto, you're going to have large segments of the population in revolt.
Yeah, could you back off the mic some?
They think the is the devil.
Yeah.
They think the woman is the devil. And on the other hand, what would the Obama thing, I mean, it's all about manipulating people's states of mind, and identity politics at the center of it. Identity politics at the center of it. And Obama's basically, he was just playing the normal career path of any politician in Chicago, right? He was raised by an atheist. His mother was an atheist. He doesn't believe in any of this stuff.
Yeah, obviously. He just went to church because, you know, that's where everybody is.
Yeah, he joins the biggest mega church in Chicago, the most politically influential, you know, well-connected mega church. I wonder what other politicians are in this church. Why haven't we heard about this? Why haven't we heard the names of the other politicians, black politicians, white politicians?
I don't know much about this church, but supposedly Hillary is in this creepy thing called the Fellowship, which is like let's be Hitler for Jesus prayer group. It's like all Republicans in Hillary. It's really weird. It's like a cult.
Well, these people will do and say anything, and they'll make any sorts of criminal arrangements with other gangster elements. What I took note of tonight was that, since you're talking about MSNBC and the media, who is Obama's main spokesman right now? It's Eric Holder. I don't know if you remember who Eric Holder was. Eric Holder was the official at the Justice Department, the Clinton Janet Reno Justice Department, who was also one of their leading spokesmen during the Waco events.
Good
times. So you're talking about a guy who basically participated, at least at the level of Janet Reno in the Justice Department, in those massacres at Waco. That's who Eric Holder is. If you look at who has promoted Obama, it's the Daley family of Chicago, and they're like a dynasty of kingmakers. They're like the medieval Dukes of Orleans or the Dukes of Norfolk in England or something. You know, they're the kingmakers. Nobody gets to be Richard T. Daley, I guess he's the current mayor of Chicago now, right? Or he was. Bill, that's amazing. They still got a Daley in there. This is the guy that negotiated NAFTA, the North American Free. This is one of the architects of the North American Union. So, you know, we don't need to go digging under Obama's bed.
A lot of finance there.
Oh, yeah. And yet these people are going to continue to delude themselves.
There's a lot of commodity trading there.
Oh, by the way, what do you make of Samantha Powers being fired from the Obama? I think there was too much attention being drawn to her and her relationship to the Ford Foundation and other globalist NGO-type outfits on the web. I started seeing her name turning up all over the web, and people were immediately drawing the connections between Obama and these elite institutions. And I think that her profile was being raised too high, and they had to drop her. It was bad PR. Those decisions are usually made for psychological or PR reasons. It wasn't because she popped off and said something about Hillary. So they clearly do not want the focus shining on them too brightly, on the elite institutions that these candidates are beholden to, that they're controlled by, that they're acting as cutouts and frontmen for. They're constantly trying to say politics is about identity.
You know what else is interesting? We got this Obama trial coming up, but guess what happened to Court TV in the past year or so, in the same time when that steam pipe exploded in front of their building? They were bought by GE, by NBC. And now they're not Court TV. They changed their name to, like, True TV. It's like True Crime TV, and they don't really cover trials anymore. So it's pretty much Phil Spector was their last gasp, and we're not going to get to see the Obama trial live on cable TV because there's no more channel. Remember that started however long ago. They just showed trials all day, and even though they showed the sensationalist trials and everything, they showed it. But, you know, we can't even see that anymore.
Well, the whole idea is to drive these things to the bottom of the barrel and make them get people fixated on tabloid stuff. Because that's, you know, court TV. Who are we kidding?
You know what the tabloid said today? The one I saw today, the Globe, I guess it is, their new Obama thing, is that Obama may have promised Oprah ambassador to the UN.
Yeah, well, this is where they start mixing in the celebrities, the Hollywood, the pop culture figures with the politicians to the point where you can't really tell the difference. They all become, I mean, look, Obama's campaign's been managed like a rock star's, right?
Yep.
You know, a charismatic, I kept thinking about Pink Floyd, The Wall, and the sequences in it where they show where Geldof plays like a dictator who's enrapturing these masses of people mm-hmm. who are in love with him. And that really, when I looked at the faces, the adoration, the almost this almost angelic, you know, faith-like adoration of these people at some of these Obama events. Watch them. Look at their faces.
Well, they faint.
A lot.
It's like the Beatles. They faint.
It's a pop star thing. It's a pop star thing. They run it. And the scripts are, after a while, you won't be able to tell the difference between the pop stars, you know, the Hollywood characters and you know, the rock stars and the television personalities and the people who are, the manipulation of populations in this is so stunning to me, and the continued dumbing down of the populations in order to get this to work, the continuing insult to people's intelligence. I refuse to believe that people are buying into this, that everybody is buying into this. I see it's being pumped out of the media constantly, but I refuse to believe that thinking people don't see that they're being manipulated and are kind of hanging back and saying, you know something, this doesn't smell right. But this sort of...
Well, yeah, there's like the French actress who got all the supposed controversy for talking about 9/11. You know, nothing happened to her. You know, people, you're a sucker if you believe 9/11.
That I had read some articles about that, and someone said something about the fact that it doesn't necessarily hurt your career in Hollywood to be known as someone who thinks that 9/11 was an inside job. Now, I don't know how much, and I read this in two different venues on the web.
Yeah, I must have seen it somewhere.
That this is what is being said out there. So maybe the idea is, well, I'm no jackass, I'm no fool. I basically know what went down. Who wants to be thought of as a fool by their friends? So, yeah, it does kind of become... The thing about things like that Jeff Hill interview is that we're going to create a situation where it becomes impossible. Impossible for anybody to go to college or even high school and study this without having to see this material, without having to see and watch and listen to this material and know what happened. We're establishing the history of it, that it's going to be the only history available, because let me tell you something, the continuously changing and morphing and conflicting pseudo-history, the myth, the gigantic house of cards of lies that these guys have built, I started to say narrative, but it's really multiple variant narratives, conflicting narratives they have about this. It's very shaky, it's very shallow. And we're building a narrative that's going to become the, for like it or not, the official cultural narrative of this. That's what we've got to do. We've got to institutionalize this to the extent that you can't study this in college unless you're listening to stuff like Jeff Hill's interviews and looking at the analysis of these videos and saying,
well,
oh my God.
All right, it's a huge cancer in the colleges already, all this homeland security crap, so...
Well, that is...
We're going to have new colleges for the most part, because the ones now aren't working.
You're right. The institutions are getting corrupted by Homeland Security money so fast. You're right, because there's no money.
What do you think about 9/11 porn? And then we're going to hear Nico's 9/11 porn review.
Right, I have mixed feelings about it. I see some people have jumped on board, and they don't necessarily like it, but they jumped on board because they think they're defending freedom of speech or something like that. It depends. If it could be done cleverly enough to really have an impact, But the stuff I've seen, to me, starts to look repetitious. I'm not sure what it's communicating. You know something, why I'm a poor judge of this? Maybe what they're doing, I know it's being called kind of a parody and a mockery and it's culture jamming. One reason
we're playing this is the audio, it's one of Nico's videos. It's a high audio content. And so it's just kind of a stream of consciousness rant about porn and sexual imagery and how it relates to 9/11. And of course, there's a YouTube version of it at 9/11 Censored, and on the that's the name of the YouTube account. And it's it's just
what you're describing here is something called culture jamming. That's what they're trying to do. My question is, well, maybe there is a substantial audience internationally, probably in Japan, for a lot. In other words, fuck America. If they're hitting a large Japanese audience or a large European audience with this.
Yeah, German audience.
Yeah, well, then maybe they're on to something.
Yeah.
But I don't know what it buys us as far as an American audience, but you got to understand, I'm willing to do anything to bring down the people in power. Anything. So that's the bottom line for me.
Of course, a fourth theory. I'm going to tell you the truth, my friend. My penis brought down Tower of London.
You better work.
This theme. Well, I call it for now, the 9/11 CGIS theme. 9/11 was also penis. This is not a crazy conceptualization. It means the terrorists of people and whoever wrote the script of 9/11, I assume Germans got involved. They're highly above all sexual. Don't make it too close up because I have to cut it up. Oh, definitely. So the Germans, who had the only real sexual revolution on number two, United States, made sure that they picked the biggest target to traumatize people. What is that? A penis. So they couldn't use a gun. The gun is not traumatizing any longer since they did Western movies. So they cannot use these horse like gun stuff anymore. Plus, a plane is for sure also more dramatic. It's a bigger penis. It destroys and kills more people, 2,000 people. And there is no bigger penis right now than the plane. It would be a rocket. But the rocket is, they couldn't use a rocket, so they had to use a passenger plane. So that traumatized the American people, because they want to rape. They are the rapists. They are the sexual, they think revolution is number one, while that is Germany. So Americans are traumatized, women felt rape, men felt rape too, because they want to rape. The women turned into new age eco-feminist fascists, finally start hating women and men again, and the men start hating women, so they turn gay. And this is what this is about. This is a show about a concept of a different kind of porn review, telling you that even porn itself gets infiltrated with gayish elements. So, first question I have is the underground. You find the so-called underground is not necessarily authentic underground. Some underground is staged. Like they're using actors over there, there's no real rape, there's staged rape. For sure they use pee and shit. Scat is coming more popular now in LA, it's less popular in New York. But very, very mainstream underground is now peeing, which infiltrated the mainstream porn. So, for instance, Cytheria is a very popular squirting artist. She revolutionizes. I'm pro squirting. I'm not so fascinated with scatting anymore. But playing the underground, if you get good underground, take it. You will be straight forever. Then we have the old Mayhem, Latino crossover school. Mayhem was one of the first popularizing Latino porn. The 90s. The early tens or zeros were a revival of Latino porn, which never really existed more. Before was snuff, rape, pickup porn, Latino cocaine chicks. Then it was now glamour Latino. So Latino over the music and hip hop revolutionized porn, and it's still the most popular porn is Latino actors. Then you have still these I call it soft porn, gay soft porn. This is the glamour model stuff, like you, that people say, oh yeah, I watch porn. Usually they talk about Janet Jameson. The real porn specialist is hard to find because these people are too gay to watch good porn. This is a good old school, new school, retro stuff. Red Light Express, always good label. Smash, a little bit slutty. Zero Tolerance is high glamour, good cool models who are doing throat gagging. Third Degree, similar label. But you see from the colors, if you closely watch this, it has some half gayish, modelish thingy in it. The old, good old school pickup stuff with Asian hookers, we had black hookers and white. I would say intelligence, operation, honeypot thing. It's cool if they have authentic people. Later staged it and used actors. And they're getting more fatter. And I like fatter, you know what I'm saying. And this is a nice, very popular porn star. It's around since five, six years, and now I forgot his name. It's a little
Cream
weird.
Cream Pie.
Cream Pie is was a late 90s term for coming actually inside again. Inside is very important because that proves that there's still inside job in porn industry. They try to get rid of inside jobs during the 80s. That's when they developed AIDS as a military weapon. So between 80s and 2000, porn turned a little bit into gay, which means no incoming anymore, no inside job. But the perps, the real cool straight guys, like incoming. So the retro nice, the incoming or the cream pie thing. Cream pie means inside job. You're coming inside. 80% of these incoming porns are real. I'm not sure what the sperm will. This is good stuff. Diabolic, formerly influenced by Polish Czech hot chicks. They're cool hot chicks. These are the party chicks you would like to meet in party. It's an old, late Diabolic. See, a lot of good porn actors come also still from Germany, like Amy Reid, Annette Schwartz. She starred in Peter Expression. This is a cool, one of the cool teenager slaps. Her name is Kat, K-A-T. Not to be confused with Kat from Underground Stuff. She still has braces, and so people like to rape actually underage. So this is actually some kind of half pedophilia nasty shit. Kat is pretty cool.
So oh, look at you, you got a whole collection here.
Yeah, well, I'm watching porn since the 70s. Actually, right now, did lead research and was watching.
Well, by the way, America, I consider myself asexual.
Yeah, I think Doug is asexual. I'm also asexual. Meanwhile, I don't like to socialize anymore. That's how they want to turn me into gay. It doesn't work out, as you see. Still enjoying my days. It's my girlfriends. We watch porn. So, and I mean, they try to infiltrate with new age chicks. Yeah, before I was a Latino chick, she was hot. So, one of the all-time favorites is for sure Max Harko. Max Harko, I think, is from Germany, lives in LA. He's the only American porn director who's still using straight transgression sex. He's an authentic, old-school retro and still on the top of everything. His promise, he cannot bring the PG stuff in the US. It's forbidden by law to do transgression and P at the same time. So what he's doing is, he's shooting also in Europe, but he's also filming here and editing out the transgression piece, reimports over Europe so that people can buy Max Hardcore with $10 extra in United States pawn shops. Problem is, they try to oppress that too, so it's very hard to find the European versions. But Max Hardcore, all-time top 3 in transgression, P and non-P crossover. This is for sure the number one transgression scat label in Germany called Experiment Ausgeliefer Sein or Innovative Productions. Innovative Productions is hardcore P, hard soft, because they're not doing transgression P, they're doing regular P. The scat people I don't like because I think they're half gay. Putting some cream on someone's face is not the kind of fantasy I would like to have. Putting my own cream on someone's face, the pee, is more fascinating. That's why I like more squirting stuff. I like women peeing, I like water, and I like the sexual impression of peeing. It is very sexual. I recommend this therefore only for people not too scared to watch, also scared at the same time, and think they could get turned gay. I don't like straight scared label stuff. This is a good crossover, I recommend. And then we have also GGG. GGG is for Munich. I have to look a little more further. GGG started Sexbox last year. Best hardcore label worldwide. Sexbox has no scared in it, so you don't be scared to get gay. Straight peeps discretion, including highest quality stage rape pee. It is legal in Germany to rape, pee, and be transgressed at the same time. It is legal in the United States to sell this stuff. So that's very fascinating that America has a law which is conservative on the rape issue. Like, you are not allowed to rape and handcuff at the same time. You can, however, rape. Handcuff is protected by law as illegal in the United States. Think about this. Is that not absurd? Peeing is allowed, which people think is disgusting. Transgression and peeing at the same time. But sex box goes further. They're handcuffed. And so there's sex box numbers here. They're sometimes confiscated by the FBI.
And there you have it. So that was a pretty interesting interesting speculation on Tavistock and the German connection to Tavistock. And he makes a good point. He didn't make the Masonic connection, you know, with the Washington Monument and the obelisk and all that and the towers. And then you get back into more Masonic stuff. And you know, there's some very... Don't disregard that 9/11 has ancient mystery origins in so many ways, and that includes alchemy. And you probably want to stay tuned to total411.info because the alchemy to 9/11 connection, it's coming, and it will be revealed possibly on Revere Radio Network as well.
There's a set on our gathering souls today. They're all 30% off from yesterday. There's 412 polyester leather, wool, and tweed. Just a Visa or MasterCard is all you need.
Direct to you. It's my size. Thank you.